The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The May issue of Our State Magazine has been focusing on moms, so we will continue through that section, which is entitled Legacy of Love, a Mother's Day Tribute. With the article coming up is Unsung Heroes. A quest to learn about her mother and grandmothers led a genealogist to the untold stories of her Outer Banks ancestors. Along the windswept dunes on the strip of barrier island wedged between Oregon and Hatteras inlets, the ghosts of long-gone bankers drift among swaying sea oats and the barbed thorns of prickly pears. Steeped in chartreuse cordgrass and rendered flaxen by goldenrod, the marsh simmers with generations of islanders lost to time. Among them are the men exalted by the storykeepers, the lifesavers, lightkeepers, fishermen, and boatbuilders, and all their ascribed heroics— stoicism, toil, and ingenuity. It's their stories that most often inspire writers, poets, and historians. But also among the souls are the anonymous and courageous women who made a life and an impact on a sliver of land jutting into the sea. Their stories, ones of hardship and bravery, exist only in the pages between those chapters dominated by men. It's the unwritten and undocumented that captivates Robin Daniels Holt. A local history buff and genealogy researcher, Holt has spent her life at the south end of Roanoke Island in Wanchese. There are numerous accounts and books about the men of the Outer Banks, she says, but there are many wives, sisters, daughters, and grandmothers whom history has left unexplored. For Holt, changing that began where most tales end, the cemetery. Over the past 150 years, time and tide had rendered their judgment on the Midget Cemetery, perched on the western edge of Hatteras Island's Chickamauga Banks. Storms had bitten away at the shoreline. With every strong west wind, chunks of the cemetery disappeared, exposing graves and tossing headstones into Pamlico Sound. Saving those interred in the shifting sand would be a race against nature. In 2015, a coalition of descendants and community members banded together and began raising money to install a bulkhead to slow the erosion. A Midget for at least 12 generations, Holt was, by blood, invested in protecting the cemetery. When I became involved, I had this realization, she says. As I was cleaning their headstones, I realized every person in there was my relative. That's my family. That epiphany added to her interest in her family's history. She continued her already years-long search so she could better understand who she was, where she came from, and the women from whom she descends. When my mother died, I wanted to know what made her, Holt says. I wanted to know why she was the way she was, what her life was like growing up, what was my grandparents' life like. And it just grew from that. I wanted to know what made me. The answer has given her a sense of belonging. When people ask me, where are you from? I can say, I'm from right here. As Holt delved more deeply into her genealogy, the archives at the Outer Banks History Center in Mandio became her sanctuary, her vestibule to the past. One day she learned about a set of diaries from a woman on Pine Island, 46 small journals written at the turn of the century by Lily Jacob Baum, a physician's wife who lived on a pocket of sand wedged between Currituck Sound and the Atlantic Ocean. Spanning 48 years, the diaries offered a rare look at the life of a woman on the Outer Banks in the first half of the 20th century. Just a glimpse, really, but a glimpse it was. Every day she wrote something in a little ledger book. They were often brief entries, leaving much to wonder, Holt recalls. I thought, there's so much written about the men, about the lifesavers, the lighthouse keepers, the fishermen, all of it. But there's nothing about the women. What did it mean for her to keep up a household? Curiosity got the better of Holt. From those daily entries, she began peeling back the layers. There are all these questions, and every time I would answer one, there'd be another. Okay, so she did laundry today. What does that mean? Soap wasn't available, so she had to make it. But soap had to be made 6 weeks ahead so it could cure, or she couldn't do the laundry. But laundry and all it involved, drawing water by hand from a well, building a fire for the cauldron, drying the clothes in humid, fickle weather, and using irons heated by coals, was but a tiny piece of any given day. With each journal entry from Baum, Holt discovered a new topic to research, unearthing a more complex story about the place and the ingenuity of the women who made the most with the least. What did it mean to grow a garden in nutrient-deficient sand? Using what they had around them, women collected oyster shells to process into lime fertilizer. Kilns were constructed of mud, sludge, and dried marsh grass, and engineered to withstand intense heat. Oysters were fired and slacked to convert the lime to calcium hydroxide suitable for gardening. What did it mean to make and mend clothes? The process began with shearing sheep and cleaning the wool before combing and dyeing it. Then, using a spinning wheel, the wool was fashioned into thread for knitting or crocheting. From all of Holt's questions, a book was in the making, her own. In a cottage that sits on the same land where Holt was raised and now lives, waist-high stacks of boxes stand by the front door. If someone had told me I'd write a book, I would never have believed it, she says. She points across her living room, but there they are, the first printing of My Daily Bounded Realm. A journal of daily life in the Outer Banks in 1900 had arrived the day before, physical proof that the women of Hatteras Island had a story to tell. With the ancestral memory of those laid to rest in the sacred grounds she was helping to preserve, inspired by the diaries of Lily Baum, and equipped with countless hours of genealogical research, Holt found a muse in her great-great-grandmother, Mary Martha O'Neill Midget. But who was she? In the 1900 census, for all the women in Chickamauga, their occupation was listed as nun or housewife. It didn't matter if they were a midwife, fisher, or preacher, Holt says. No matter who her great-great-grandmother really was, on paper, she had been reduced to a binary. Holt pondered what Martha would have written in a journal. She questioned what her day held, both the fantastic and the mundane. A vision took shape. The U.S. government made out of recognized a women's contribution at that time, she says. But I'll tell you what, they all had degrees in domestic engineering, in my opinion. To do what they did with the resources they had, she trails off. Imagining a world without electricity, running water, or paved roads. They had to be intelligent, staunch women. Holt's genealogy had become not only a conduit to her past, but also a window into better understanding the ecology and natural history of the region, lost food traditions, and cultural and community customs. In her book, organized like the diary that inspired her, the brief, fictitious journal entries of her great-great-grandmother, each an amalgam of archival research, personal experience, and local folklore, are gateways to exploring the very real history of the place. Holt gives an in-depth historical context to household responsibilities like preparing meals, washing clothes, maintaining fires, fetching water, and raising children, painting a more complete, a more colorful picture of life on the Outer Banks. In reality, women were leaders in the revolution of animal husbandry. They played a critical role in the fishing industry by making and mending nets to provide food and income. And they cared for their communities and families as herbalists, healers, and midwives. Like many women at the turn of the century, Holt's great aunt, Lucy May Midget's life was reduced to the household chores she performed. Holt honors her history as a commercial fisherman, decoy carver, builder, and church pastor. She pays homage to the groups of women who made clothing for people rescued from shipwrecks. The only benevolent resource of aid once survivors reach land empty-handed. She recognizes Bashi Foster, the self-taught nurse and midwife from Hatteras Village who ministered and delivered babies for at least 15 years. A century and a quarter later, Holt has taken a monochromatic history and portrayed a vibrant, complex picture that explores the skills, talents, and ingenuity that define the women of the Outer Banks. For a person whose family can be traced to the colonial era, exploring her genealogy is how Holt defines and grounds herself. When tracing ancestry in a place as small and remote as the Outer Banks, the connections can become a tangled web. "I don't call my genealogy a tree," she says. "It's a wreath. It just keeps going around and weaving in and out. Sometimes there's a little sprig off this way, but it's more a wreath than it is a tree." It's an appropriate metaphor given that wreaths often symbolize completeness. Studying her family lineage to complete her own story has made the story of women whose lives have lain hidden in shadows more visible. Holt has honored their memory by bringing their struggles and triumphs into the light. She still helps care for the Midget family cemetery. "At least twice a year, I go down there and help keep it cleaned up. Every now and then, I pat Martha's headstone and say, 'Martha, I hope I do you proud.'" These moments in which Holt communes with the past have made the present all the more complete, blurring the lines between where things begin and where they end, just like the wreath that is her family history. The next article is entitled "Climbing Together." For one family, summiting Stone Mountain is a tradition that strengthens the bond between parent and child. And we have a picture here. It says the rider and her two sons have hiked many trails and summited lots of peaks, but Stone Mountain's granite dome holds special memories. And they're looking out over from the peak, looking out over into the mountains. "We were supposed to be serious in the picture, as if we were a family who naturally leaned. But it's hard to stop a six-year-old boy from sticking out his tongue. Plus, the sun was too bright not to squint. The way my dad remembers it, while he and Uncle Roger set up the trick shot, we cousins ran around on the top of Stone Mountain like circus cats." They're actually leaning sideways, making the picture look sideways. Four young people. Looks like about 1960s or early 70s. And they're all leaning over, and the picture looks that way. It's cute. "My sister Karen and cousin Kim walked on their hands. I hopped rock to rock, barefoot in ripped bell-bottom jeans and an oversized Schlitz malt liquor t-shirt. My uncle Raj recalls wondering how far he'd have to go before he went over the edge, which is entirely possible on Stone Mountain. Somehow we coalesced on that big bald summit and leaned over as instructed. Cousin Raj stuck out his tongue. Dad snapped the photo. It was 1975. There are more trips to Stone Mountain. That's where we learned that wearing cut-off jeans was the only way to protect your butt when sliding down the lower falls. My dad loved the outdoors, so our family was often outside. We walked railroad tracks, biked to Ocracoke, hiked portions of the Appalachian Trail. Being home was no less of an adventure. There was always somebody in our tiny guest room, bedroom. Didgeridoo players, writers, tennis players, musicians, scientists. Mom celebrated every holiday, no matter how insignificant. She even made up a few, like reward night, where she'd pass around a paper bag filled with candy. You couldn't reach in until someone could recount something positive or kind you'd done that week. I didn't get much candy when I was 14. Dad always said, 'You lay a feast out on the table for your children,' Karen said recently, as we mused about the kinds of mothers we'd become and how our childhood shaped us. You know your kids aren't going to choose everything, but they're going to choose some things, so you lay the feast. Mom and Dad had so many things they loved, they laid quite a feast. The feast I laid for my own kids was a bit more restrained, partly because I was divorced and had two energetic boys. Introducing them to things I loved had to be squeezed in between soccer practice, sleepovers, making supper, and baking cupcakes late at night for holiday parties at school. I couldn't figure out how my parents had done it all when we were kids. Hiking was a family tradition, so I decided to focus on that. I invited Dad to join me and the boys for our first family hike. We chose Hadaway Mountain, a 3-mile moderate trail in Moro Mountain State Park, not far from the mill village where my dad grew up. I packed juice boxes and goldfish crackers. The boys were excited. After we showed them how to follow trail markers, they sprinted off into the wilderness. The whining began after a quarter mile. Dad and I passed some bickering on a switchback soon after that. By the time we reached the top, we were carrying one, nearly dragging the other. One needed to pee, the other lay on a log, chewing a dry mouthful of goldfish, having finished off his juice shortly after we left the parking lot. "Are we there yet?" he asked, not lifting his head. Trying not to sound too disappointed when he realized the summit of Hadaway Mountain bore no resemblance to photos he'd seen of the Alps. The elation of finally getting back into the car was sufficient to erase the misery of the experience. The ride home was cheerful and upbeat. We didn't mention how badly things had gone. A few weeks later, my oldest son, Keenan, was asked at school to share something he was proud of. He drew a picture of Hadaway Mountain. I called my dad immediately. We laughed and laughed. What a revelation that was for me. Our failed hike had become a keystone memory in our sweet boy's life. Keenan didn't remember or care that the hike had been a nightmare. He was excited that he'd done something new. This redefined the feast for me. It was more than attainable than I thought. It was simply sharing your excitement, teaching your kids to be curious people. It was an attitude fueled by my parents' enthusiasm. All my favorite childhood memories had these two ingredients: eating cereal for supper, cleaning out our car after our dog threw up. Those experiences and so many more were part of our feast. Climbing Stone Mountain was our family's rite of passage. This time, I packed chocolate and lots of water, and I let go of any expectations that it would go well. It didn't matter. The trail was tough. My younger son, Aslan, whom we call Oz, hated it. If he had been older and knew how, folks 17 miles away in downtown Elkin would have heard him cuss as he hiked. But the boys loved the bald summit. Nobody did a handstand at the top, but they ran around stunned at the unexpected view. A few years later, Keenan was diagnosed with an anxiety disorder, an unexpected turn that we embraced by learning everything we could about it. Medication and therapy helped some. He even learned to meditate. One thing that also helped was hiking. So we started, one tentative step at a time, beginning with the North Carolina state parks: Pilot Mountain, Stone Mountain, Crowder's Mountain. "Where will you take us today?" I whispered more than once as we set off on a new trail. That first year, I lost count of how many miles we covered. Keenan began studying maps and researching gear. He got strong. He made lists of mountains he wanted to climb and epic hikes he wanted to tackle, most of which I'd never heard of. Last fall, he left for Warren Wilson College in the Blue Ridge Mountains. The most important thing on his packing list wasn't a mattress topper or a coffee pot. It was a satellite communicator. Less than half a pound, it fits in the palm of his hand. Sometimes it's the only way his dad and I can find him. When he's not in class, he's on a trail, often too far off the grid for his mobile phone to work. If he does have service, he'll FaceTime his grandfather from the top of a mountain. Oz also loves hiking now, especially when their dad, Ertl, joins us. Sometimes life is messy. Then it's not. After our divorce, we became best friends again. Recently, the four of us hiked more than 60 miles during a family trip to Montana. Ertl is a hoot. He grew up in a small village in Turkey and pretends not to understand American trail etiquette. He wears his coat slung over his shoulders like a cape and hollers greetings and encouraging information to everyone we pass. "Good job! You're almost there!" He's handsome and his accent is lovely, but it's hard to place, so hikers are either too charmed or befuddled to notice if he mistakenly says something inappropriate. "Your dog is so cute. He's also fat." When I visit Keenan at school, he takes me on hikes. He maps the trail and packs the snacks, protein bars, hydration powders. I hate goldfish. He wants to become a wilderness first responder, so his day pack is stocked and organized. I can't keep up with him anymore, so after he's explained elevation gains or trees to look for, he takes off and I take my time. We always meet at the summit. Last summer, he took me to the Adirondacks. On one of the trails, I came across a tricky section submerged in water. I wasn't sure I could cross the planks without falling in, but I followed his muddy footprints. Further on, things got really steep and I had to stop and rest a lot. I was surprised Keenan hadn't backtracked to see if I was okay. Stone by stone, I made it. After a while, I came around a bend, and there he was, sitting on a rock waiting for me, just like I used to do for him. I wasn't worried. I knew you could do it, he said, but I also know you don't like heights, so I thought we'd hike the next part together. And if you'd like to check out Stone Mountain State Park, it's on Frank Parkway in Roaring Gap, North Carolina. And you can search for it on the northncparks.gov website. Well, we finished all the Mother's Day stories, and so now I'll do another featured story called A New Day for the New Ray. The oldest hotel in North Carolina was saved from the wrecking ball and has returned to its former glory on the square in downtown Burnsville. The New Ray Hotel stretches out beside Burnsville's town square like a graceful dowager awakening from her afternoon nap, a southern vision of rocking chairs, porch, and balcony. As the oldest continuously operating hotel in the state, the New Ray is finally rising from a 30-year slumber that once saw stately property, saw the once stately property slide into deep decline. This should have been condemned, admits James Keith, who now runs the circa 1833 hotel with his wife Amanda. Give up, tear it down, or power through were their only choices, he said. The fruits of their labor were all set to debut in August of 2024, just in time to house the rescue workers and swift water response teams who poured into the area immediately after Hurricane Helene swept through. Even the New Ray's new metal sign was ripped from the front porch and left crumpled like a gum wrapper in the storm's aftermath. Through it all, the Keiths wouldn't give up on the New Ray, Amanda said. It was still the sweet building on the square. In its 192-year-old history, it's been referred to by many names, from the New-Ray Hotel to the New Ray Inn, and now the New Ray Hotel. When it first opened for guests, Yancey County had just been formed, and the town of Burnsville wouldn't be founded for another year. When a ginseng trader called Bacchus Smith built a small tavern and trading post out of logs. It had 8 rooms, 4 on the bottom and 4 on the top, where travelers could stay the night. Around 1867, Smith sold the place to Garrett Ray, who expanded it, keeping the original log constructed section and adding an east wing that stretched along the square. He named it Ray's Hotel, which was the locals dubbed the Old Ray. In 1915, Ray's daughter Julia and her husband William Bryan Ray, W-R-A-Y, inherited the hotel after Ray, R-A-Y, died, and renovated it again, adding a west wing, a bigger kitchen, and dining room and running water and electricity. They renamed it the New Ray, that's N-U-W-R-A-Y, hotel, as a play on the Old Ray, R-A-Y. Julia and W.B. ran it together until he died in 1932. Julia kept the hotel running with the help of their children until she died 35 years later. Her children, Annie Ray Bennett and Rush Ray, kept it going until they died in the 1980s. Other family members stepped in to help, but the Rays finally sold the property in 1993. It changed hands several times after that and went through foreclosure. That's when the Keiths found it. James and Amanda took a roundabout route to their career as historic inn restorers. As students in Greensboro, where she got her master's degree in publishing, and he got his master's and doctoral degrees in musical conducting, they found a historic home near the UNCG campus and restored it. There, they earned reputations for throwing parties and hosting visiting scholars. After they graduated and got jobs in their respective fields, they returned to their mutual attraction and to old build. They turned to their mutual attraction of old buildings that needed a little love. This time, they bought a 1906 Colonial Revival in Greensboro that they restored and opened as a bed and breakfast, and discovered they loved hospitality as much as restoration. The couple was looking for another project when they bought a cabin in Bakersville. On the drive back and forth between the mountains and Greensboro, they regularly passed through Burnsville, where they first crossed paths with the New Ray. Even in disrepair, the bones of the old hotel and its historic place in the center of its community intrigued them. In October 2021, the Keiths bought the almost derelict hotel for $1.5 million. We knew we were taking a big bite, Amanda says, but until they opened the walls and the ceilings, they didn't truly understand just how big. During the New Ray's first three iterations, building codes were loose or non-existent. In these remote areas of the mountains, people built however they could and with whatever they had. The Keiths kept some bookings that were made by the previous owners, which proved to be a learning experience. At a wedding reception right after they bought the hotel, James stood to one side of a dining room full of guests and realized the floor was bowing beneath their feet. In fact, the entire place was a renovation nightmare. The original knob and tube wiring was still hot and ready to spark a fire. Load-bearing walls had no studs. A 55-foot steel beam made in Yancey County had to be installed in the basement just to keep the structure standing. Along the way, they tried to save or highlight everything they could. In an upper hallway, the original wall was left uncovered so you could see the logs and the way it all sloped. In an upstairs parlor, Amanda covered a section of wall with plexiglass so guests could see wallpaper that was used in the hotel in the late 1800s and wood siding that was used in the 1833 version of the building. The new Ray has one more phase to be unveiled, which is expected to be completed in late May, the reopening of its restaurant. For decades, the old New Ray was known for family-style dinners of Appalachian classics like smoked hams made in a smokehouse on site. Recreating those exact foods is difficult in the 21st century, since many recipes, like the formula for those hams, are lost to history. Instead, the Keiths hope to pay homage to the hotel's storied meals of the past. They've hired Peter Crockett, who worked at Issa's Bistro in Asheville, to run the newly renovated kitchen. James also is busy in the basement setting up a bar to be called the washroom. Behind it, the centerpiece will be the original wooden laundry agitator, once run by steam and finally hooked up to electricity in the 1940s. Meanwhile, the big stone fireplace is burning again in the lobby. Locals stop by on afternoon walks to sit by the fire and catch up on a place that has been there all their lives. So much of it, Amanda says, lives on in people's memories. Now they'll have a chance to make new ones of their own. The New Ray Hotel is located at 102 Town Square in Burnsville, North Carolina. And they have a website, newray.com, and that's spelled N, like November, U, WRAY.com. And there's a few pictures here. Today's rooms are a graceful mix of old and new, and they have an old lamp with a, probably at one point was a gas lit lamp. I have a picture of Elvis on the wall, and they've got like an iron bed with pillows. Looks very reminiscent of something old. They have lots of photos around the historic photos that show the early opulence of the former hotel. Well, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired and is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions or comments, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.